Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
It's very important to prevent another war in Gaza. I think there's very few events that could occur that will do more damage to the Obama administration's foreign policy than to have another war in Gaza.
Bradley Burstyn joins us to talk about his story in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that another Gaza war may be looming. He asks, can Obama stop it before it starts? Bradley Burstyn cited what he called a coolly terrifying analysis by Yom Tov Samiya, former overall Israeli military commander of the Gaza Strip and the adjacent Negev. There have also been tensions between Israel and Turkey after strong language by Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan. He criticized Israel for recent attacks on Gaza and their threats of more violence. Erdogan has warned Lebanon, too, that Israel may be planning an attack on its northern neighbor, and there are anecdotal reports of Israeli soldiers training in the Negev. These heightened tensions coincide with Israel's insistence on continuing to push Palestinians from their homes to make way for new settlements. The Obama administration has asked Israel to stop building settlements altogether. Israel has declined. For strong supporters of Israel, the debate centers on the problem of rockets launched from Gaza into Israel, something Mideast expert Phyllis Bennis said are illegal, since they're not strictly against military targets. She added that they could have been stopped had Israel agreed to maintain a ceasefire and come to the table for talks with Hamas.
Israel had the exact right way to stop the rocket fire, which was indeed and remains illegal because it can't be aimed at military forces. Certainly an occupied population under international law has the right to resist, including the right to use military force against a military occupation. But that right is not absolute. It does not extend to attacks on civilians. And because these very primitive rockets cannot really be aimed at military targets, they end up being pointed towards civilian targets, which makes them illegal. Israel had the exact way of challenging that rocket fire, which had worked all through the 5.5 months of the ceasefire in 2008, where the number of rockets had dropped from, on some occasions, as much as 200 a month, there were really quite a few, down to 2. It had dropped more than 90%. All they needed to do, instead of going to war, was to return to the ceasefire, which they had broken dramatically on November 4th, 2008, before their invasion and attack, when they launched a massive set of airstrikes in Gaza, killing 6 Palestinians. That was what brought the ceasefire to an end. Their obligation to stop the rocket fire would be to return to the ceasefire. And I think that's what was missing here. It's one of the weaknesses, ironically enough, of the Goldstone Report, is that the Goldstone Report does not get into the question of whether the use of force at all by Israel was in fact legal. And others, including Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories for the UN, Professor Richard Falk, has indicated that it was not legal because they had the option of using a non-military approach to ending the rocket fire, that being a return to the ceasefire. Returning to the ceasefire and negotiating was what they needed to do, and they didn't. They chose war instead, and we're seeing the consequences now.
Between late December and early January, the IDF launched several airstrikes into Gaza, also shooting dead at least 12 Palestinians between December 26th and January 13th. The strikes killed both militants and civilians. Missiles have been launched against Israel without causing any damage, according to the Jerusalem Post, which puts the number at 20. Bradley Burstyn is a columnist for Israel's Haaretz newspaper and senior editor of Haaretz.com, where he publishes his blog. You can read his reports at Huffington Post. Bradley Burstyn served in the IDF as a combat medic prior to turning to journalism. He joined us by phone from Israel, and we asked him to describe his piece about a possible second war in Gaza.
It's interesting that one of the things that I've been hearing is that there are a number of officials in Hamas who are working very hard to make sure that there's no escalation from the Palestinian side. It's a grave concern to Hamas that there actually is not a flare-up and that they don't cause some sort of escalation or that some rogue militants in Gaza fire off rockets without Hamas's or in contrary to Hamas's wishes, because they truly want to continue with the negotiating process over a prisoner exchange with Israel.
You cite recent comments by former Israeli military commander in Gaza, Yom Tov Samia. What's the seriousness of those comments and the possibility Israel might launch another major attack on Gaza?
Well, I think what it is something of a lobbying campaign by some retired generals who still nurse the feeling that it's possible to affect a regime change in Gaza and to essentially do some sort of tremendous damage to Hamas, something which I think is the military in general, I think Israelis in general, are skeptical about that feeling. But it does still exist, and the fact is that in the back of some people's minds, there is the feeling that somehow you could solve through warfare something that you couldn't solve through diplomatic means, which is trying to bring down Hamas.
Tell us about this commander, Yom Tov Samia. At one time, his area of command was Gaza.
Yes, he was the overall commander of the Gaza Strip during the first years of the second Palestinian uprising in the early part of the last decade. And he was very tough-minded, very single-minded in his feeling about Hamas and what has to be done, really rejects the possibility of diplomatic contact with Hamas doing very much good.
But you're also citing the comments of a retired brigadier general who served under Samia. This is Zakai. He also would come to command the IDF's Gaza division. And you say he wants a fundamental reappraisal of how Israelis should regard Hamas. Quoting him, "The state of Israel must understand that Hamas rule in Gaza is a fact, and it is with that government that we must reach a situation of calm."
Right, and I think that this is where the Obama administration could actually play a very constructive role, because formally Israel cannot negotiate with Hamas. It would imply a form of political recognition that Israel is completely unwilling to even consider at this point. And at the same time, Hamas has exactly the mirror image problem. Hamas cannot negotiate directly with Israel because it not only does not recognize Israel, it's formally committed to eliminating Israel or not having a state of Israel. And so where the United States can actually come in to help this situation is to foster indirect negotiations, which in any case are going on through other mediators between Hamas and Israel, and to try to keep the peace through a back channel continuous form of negotiation.
And this is all coming up at a time when there are other operations going on. Egypt building its own wall to separate Egypt from Gaza at the border, and further operations to destroy or dismantle the tunnel system that right now the people of Gaza rely on for basic survival needs.
Right. Here again, I think some form of hands-on American diplomacy could be very helpful. The question is, why does Egypt, on the one hand, and Israel, on the other, want to keep this siege going against Hamas? But the fact is that the original idea of the siege was to bring down Hamas, was to choke it, was to cause people to rise up against Hamas. But it's often backfired. The siege has actually increased Hamas's popularity and its political strength. But I think that what's really important here is that the siege doesn't really help anyone. It is tremendously detrimental to the population of Gaza, but it doesn't help either Israel or Egypt either. I think at some point, the question of alleviating the siege has to become a part of these indirect negotiations that are going on between Hamas and, on the one hand, Egypt, on the other hand, Israel.
Well, of course, there's a lot of emphasis on rockets from Gaza, and especially the town of Sderot. And actually, though, you write that the mayor there, David Busgilla, has said something negative about the military solution, that it results in continued escalations. Obviously, that's not good for them.
Right. And I think what he's saying here is that they won't expect any kind of military operation, even a massive military operation, to be effective in any kind of permanent way. And if that's true, and he's certainly not, he's not ruling out military intervention, but I think what you can also take away from this statement, and certainly David Busquilla is very close to the situation and keeps his finger on the pulse, he lives in it. I think what you can take away with this from the situation is the sense that the military offensive aimed at responding to rockets or trying to prevent rockets simply is not the answer, and that there has to be some other way found to establish some sort of arrangement by which Israel, on the one hand, and the Gazans can coexist, if not in peace, then it's certainly in a state of some sort of non-belligerency, where at least civilians are left out of the conflict.
And we've certainly seen cases before where these kinds of threats conveyed via radio or television, either to Hamas or in some other way to Palestinians, have actually become manifest in action on Israel's part. We're taking this seriously here, of course, because your language in this piece of a potential second attack on Gaza, the looming war in Gaza, can Obama stop it before it starts? Not only does it seem very serious that this threat was delivered publicly via radio, that of course has political connotations, but also the idea that you've said next week or the week after, Barack Obama may well see intelligence reports of tank battalions moving south and west along Israeli highways, and the whole infantry brigades setting up camp in the western Negev. Very serious, and possibly very soon.
Yes, I think that the next few days will tell how things are going to go. I think that there are a number of elements here. It's a very complicated situation. Even Iran has something to say about this, because Iran increasingly in the last few years has had an effect on Hamas's decision making and whether Hamas wants to see a certain escalation or doesn't. And I think that the next few days will really tell whether this kind of juggernaut builds toward escalation or whether there's a pullback on both sides. Today was rather hopeful. It appeared that both sides were kind of pulling back from this spiral of escalation we've been feeling over the last week. But you'll be able to tell in the next few days how it's going. If rockets are fired on the one hand, and if the Israeli Air Force attacks sites in Gaza on the other, then this buildup toward a possible conflagration may continue. You'll see it in the news if it's happening.
Israel's Defense Minister Ehud Barak is pushing for Iron Dome. This is the missile defense system. And he's claiming that the incursion into Gaza last winter made Hamas reluctant to resume rocket fire. And in combination with Iron Dome, you know, they would have security.
Actually, it's truly a shame that Israel did not work faster toward trying to develop this Iron Dome. Iron Dome was an anti-missile system, which actually might have, had Israel worked on it faster and concentrated on developing this system faster, which they actually could have done about 10 years ago, it might have prevented the Gaza war altogether. As it is, unfortunately, the anti-missile system now is still in its experimental stage, and unfortunately what we've been hearing now is that it probably won't be deployed for a matter of years, which means it sort of takes it out of, there was a hope earlier in the week that this could actually be a factor in making Israelis feel it's less necessary to go to war. But unfortunately, now what we're seeing is that this system is not going to be deployed for a while. And so the Israeli towns along the Gaza Strip are once again going to feel defenseless.
We've been interviewing people who joined the Gaza Freedom March, and they were hopeful that, you know, they could open up a new citizen diplomatic initiative with Gaza, get the border open to more food and medical supplies, which is something that the UN and other non-governmental organizations are clamoring for. But the Egyptian government denied them access. And then when they protested that decision, you know, peacefully, some were attacked, beaten up. But we also heard about the Viva Palestina March, and we're trying to understand what happened. This is the march with British PM Galloway. At Gaza's border with Egypt, there were some leaders of Hamas making speeches, and then shooting broke out. Now, we've heard reports that the Palestinian Authority had shot into the air, at which point, you know, the sides opened fire. An Egyptian policeman killed, 12 Palestinians shot.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, there were a number of unfortunate elements that were encountered by the peace activists. They certainly were not treated well by the Egyptian authorities. The Egyptian authorities didn't want them to get to Gaza. And apparently, unfortunately, it coincided with a protest from the Palestinian side, from the Gazan side, over this wall that the Egyptians are building to try to cut off the tunnels. And there were other unfortunate elements that they encountered as well, one of them being that apparently the Hamas authorities in Gaza were very restrictive and placed all kinds of limitations on the kinds of things they could do when a small delegation was finally allowed into the Gaza Strip, because of some 1,300 activists that began this journey, I think only about 100 were allowed into Gaza by the Hamas authorities. And then all of these activists have had trouble. Many tried to get in somehow from the Israeli side, and that's impossible. So this, unfortunately, what might have been a very positive mood, I think, ended in this kind of the local complexity and chaos, you know, that many well-meaning efforts meet here.
I think some of the people that we had spoken with, and a few of them were local, you know, college students who had gone with great hopes of making a difference. They were sober, to say the least, about events, but they also still feel committed that something has to be done. And certainly you're saying in your piece in Haaretz that, you know, the Obama administration must step in to, in your words, defuse the war wagon before it once again engulfs Gaza.
I think it's very important for the Obama administration's foreign policy in general, if there is a feeling, and there certainly is on the part of the administration, that they have to make a new approach to the Muslim world. And certainly in order to foster their efforts in Afghanistan, or also to shore up their efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and not to appear to be an enemy of Islam and Muslims, it's very important to prevent another war in Gaza. I think it's very, very few events that could occur that will do more damage to the Obama administration's foreign policy than to have another war in Gaza.
And you have described a few of the steps that President Obama might take if he wants to take the peacekeeper's role here. Why don't you go over what some of the things are to kind of change this now from a military potential to a diplomatic one?
First of all, I think that it's very important for Washington to try to foster the negotiations over a prisoner exchange. These are negotiations that were somewhat truncated, but they've continued again. The general picture is that Hamas is demanding about 1,000 Palestinians be freed in return for the captive Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. This, I think, is the real prerequisite to some sort of progress, you know, both in countering the possibility of war and also moving toward or moving back toward the peace process. Another way to go is to try to help to convince Israel to alleviate the siege and to help convince Egypt not to clamp down on the siege in order to ease the plight of the people of Gaza. If Israel and Egypt are willing to use that as a concession, then I think we can see a situation where you can start moving back toward the possibility of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations toward a future settlement.
Can you explain for us what you mean? You have said that this former military official from Israel, from the IDF, Samia, hinted that a new war might mean that Israeli forces would capture this Philadelphia corridor. And you also quote a professor from Ben-Gurion University saying that the message is that Egypt, too, is setting out a border and views any effort to touch it as an attack on its national security. That, of course, a deepening and a widening of this whole crisis.
Yeah, I think it's something of a nightmare scenario that former General Samia was referring to. He referred to it very obliquely, but it was clear that the hint was that if Israel were to invade Gaza again, they might capture this border strip between Palestinian Gaza and Egyptian Sinai. It's a short piece of land, but it's the border strip which actually divides the city in South Gaza and North Sinai of Rafiah or Rafah. And this city, which is divided in by this strip, which is half Egyptian and half Gazan, is where all the tunnels are. The tunnels run under this strip, and it's also where the Egyptians are building this wall. But the Egyptians are very adamant that it would be a grave error for Israel, diplomatically and otherwise, to actually attempt something like that, taking that area. I think that part of the process of building the wall is a warning. It's a warning both to the Palestinians and to Israel at the same time. That it's a warning to the Palestinians that the Egyptians have the power to choke off Gaza if they want, and it's a warning to the Israelis to stay away from that area and not return.
And what about, too, this whole question of the financial angle? Because I know a lot of money has been pouring into this region in the form of U.S. Increase in arms to Israel, coming without strings very recently. And now also there's a lot of money at stake for Egypt in terms of this border operation they're running in general. Some have talked about, you know, contractors moving into the region and perhaps once again seeing the kind of financial element to all of this that we've seen in other war scenarios that the U.S. and major powers have been involved in.
Well, it's a little difficult to tell. Unfortunately, you know, armament has been, in the sense of all kinds of armament, there's a continual increase, a continual influx of arms into this area. And it's very dangerous because, unfortunately, when you have arms, there's, you know, it increases the possibility that you may use them. There's no question that Hamas has built up its strength in terms of the number of rockets that it has. Hezbollah has been building up its strength. Israel is building up its strength. And one of the problems, of course, is that they don't feel a tremendous financial bind in doing so because the Israeli arms are coming from the United States in many cases in the form of military aid. Hezbollah and Hamas's arms are coming free of charge, courtesy of Iran. And so the peoples here don't feel a financial strain, but their sponsors probably should.
Now, we saw a kind of disturbing piece in Interpress Service News about the idea that possibly in Gaza today, there's some vulnerability to the development of maybe a little bit of affinity with an Al-Qaeda type group.
And yes. There's no question that Hamas fears this and, in fact, has taken action against it. We're not talking about large numbers, but there's no question Al-Qaeda is trying to infiltrate Gaza. And, in fact, there's been open fighting. There was an attack by Hamas people on a mosque that was controlled by these Al-Qaeda-linked rebels or insurgents, and a number of people were killed. A number of these insurgents were killed, including the leader of this sort of local insurgency. What Hamas is worried about is that even though it's a fundamentalist Islamic movement, it is not, and in a very religious Muslim area, the Gaza is much more religious, much more devout on the average than is the West Bank. What Al-Qaeda is saying there is that Islamic religious law should become the law of Gaza. And Hamas has avoided these very strict Muslim decrees that have been, you know, put into place in other areas where fundamentalists are in charge, because they've been trying to affect a balance. First of all, it's always been their ideology that people should come to Islam on their own. It shouldn't be legislated. That's always been the Hamas ideology, as opposed to some of their more fundamentalist rivals who say, no, you have to impose Islamic religious law immediately and absolutely. And that's the debate. And so Hamas is continually looking over its shoulder because they're vulnerable to charges that they are not fundamentalist enough.
Let me just cite IPS in their piece. I believe it's dated January 11, 2010, Mel Frickberg, and he's quoting Ahmed Youssef, the foreign advisor to Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader, saying, quote, "We will keep the situation under control and will never allow these groups to bring disorder to our streets again." Now, all of this, of course, in the context of some bomb attacks on internet cafes in Gaza. Of course, again, a reminder, and this is what is being said in this piece, that extremist groups within the coastal territory may be stronger than the moderate Hamas organization, which rules the Strip. Of course, Israel is degrading the strength of Hamas.
Yeah, I think what you have to recall also is that Hamas has to consider Palestinian public opinion as a whole, and the majority of Palestinians in the Palestinian territories live in the West Bank. They are more moderate. They are less fundamentalist in outlook. And Hamas wants to appeal to the broad Palestinian public. They cannot take the step of being perceived as a narrow, rigid, ultra-fundamentalist group if they want to appeal to the broader Palestinian public, which includes also Christians.
You know, it's interesting that in Yemen, we've just seen the Deputy Prime Minister for Security and Defense issue a warning to the U.S., really, and the world, that direct intervention by the U.S. strengthens al-Qaeda.
Yeah, it can backfire in any number of ways. You don't want to be perceived as being an occupying force, because that will backfire immediately. You also run the risk, if a Western nation, not only the United States, also Britain, brings in large forces, al-Qaeda can evoke the image of the crusader, and these are these foreign crusaders coming in here to take us over once again, and then it becomes this, what the United States certainly does not want, is to be pictured as this Christian crusade coming in to take over and destroy the Muslim world as the enemy of Islam and the enemy of the Muslims. So it's a very delicate situation, and it's already at a point where I don't think anyone can really tell right now how things will go in Afghanistan, how things will go in Iraq, or how things will go in Yemen. And certainly, it's very important for the administration, if they want to affect some kind of positive result in these places, to make sure that a new front doesn't open up in Gaza.
Bradley Burstyn, will continue to follow your story about the potential for a second Gaza war. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't asked you about?
I would be delighted if this turns out to be a complete false alarm, to say that no war happens. I think that one of the reasons for writing about this, actually, and one of the reasons we're talking about this and being aware of this, is to try to keep the momentum from moving toward warfare and try to move the momentum the other direction towards some kind of accommodation, some kind of coexistence.
Bradley Burstyn is a columnist for Israel's Haaretz newspaper and senior editor at Haaretz.com. Bradley Burstyn, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Bradley Burstyn was a combat medic in the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, before turning to journalism. You can read his analysis titled "The Looming War in Gaza, Can Obama Stop It Before It Starts?" at Haaretz.com or at Huffington Post. Bradley Burstyn was Gaza correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and served as the paper's military correspondent in the 1991 Gulf War. He was raised in L.A., later moving to Israel, where he joined a kibbutz. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio downloads, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com.